Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The first of Delaware's new sober living homes is up and running, offering medical treatment for addiction and much more.
We're talking about not just treatment for substance use disorder. We're talking about life skills. We're talking about socialization skills. We're talking about working on a trauma.
Our Nick Shalino has more on how these new facilities work and the question of how to sustain them long term. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also meet the authors of a children's book that aims to help girls of color love their skin tone and learn more about a program that explains Odessa's connection to the Underground Railroad. Plus, a look ahead to a new baseball season for the Blue Rocks. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Delaware added the first of its four planned state-funded sober living homes earlier this year, and it's the first facility in the state designated by the National Alliance for Recovery Residences as Level 4. That means it combines both wraparound medical treatment for addiction and job training programs for its residents. But as Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino reports, the long-term strategy for funding this and other sites coming to the first state is still being worked out.
Be able to access them. And so you're going to see the same kinds of barriers that you're experiencing today.
The morning workforce development session is underway at the Refuge in Bear. A group of about a dozen men are gathered around Saad Solomon, who is leading a discussion on overcoming systemic barriers. Solomon runs the nonprofit group Peace by Peace, which seeks to help offenders find work as they transition back into society. The state has contracted him to bring his program to this new sober living facility.
Well, it's an adapted curriculum from a bunch of different kinds of modules. So call my program the Frankenstein, right? It is quite literally pulled from all of these different modules, these different manuals that have been endorsed by the Department of Labor or our workforce boards.
Solomon is teaching soft skills like interviewing and networking etiquette. He's also connecting participants with employers and trying to equip them with the skills they need to retain work after they find it.
We have a job readiness piece. We have a cognitive behavioral piece that really addresses the thought processes and the way that people think about work and how they approach work.
The group this morning are not residents at the Refuge. Most are offenders involved in the Plummer Center Work Release Program. They bus from that center in Wilmington to the Refuge on weekdays to work with Solomon or other members of his team.
I'm from Sussex County, but I had asked to get transferred up this way because I knew there was a lot of different opportunities up this way, and I heard about the program once I was in the Plummer Center, and since I've been enrolled in it, I mean, it's definitely creating opportunities and avenues to go down.
That's Jason McBroom. He struggled for years abusing heroin, but says he is hoping to use Solomon's program to help resume his career in construction. He says the next step after he's through at the Plummer Center might be to move into a sober living facility like the Refuge.
I'm really, really highly thinking about it. I want to try to leave everything that was in the past and try to start over, start fresh. And I think this is going to be a good foundation point to start over. You know, I really, really do.
The Refuge has 30 beds available for male residents in recovery. There's also a 20-bed facility for women nearby called the Leona Mays House. Full-time residents have access to both Solomon's professional development program as well as mental health and addiction treatment with medical professionals. They can also access medication-assisted treatment with Suboxone or Vivitrol. The medical component is managed by Aquila of Delaware. Its executive director is Michelle McIver.
And we're talking about not just treatment for substance use disorder. We're talking about life skills. We're talking about socialization skills. We're talking about working on a trauma. We're talking about getting to the exact nature of why individuals have a substance use disorder.
McIver says the Refuge and Leona Mays House have added to the state's treatment capacity and made it easier for people with substance abuse disorder to access long-term treatment in Delaware.
We've made room for individuals who been probably, you know, not necessarily been able to get the services based on maybe not having a Social Security card at the time, or maybe not having this, you know, so these marginalized populations of people who haven't been able to receive treatment now are able to come here.
State officials say about $1.2 million from Delaware's budget went towards launching these new facilities. The rest of the cost is covered by federal grants from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. But Delaware's Substance Abuse and Mental Health Director Elizabeth Romero says the state is still strategizing how to fund sober living long term.
We're really evaluating kind of sustainability and looking at different models and how they pay for it in Maryland and different places like that. So we'll be working towards, again, a sustainability plan over the course of this.
Maryland is currently funding 12 Level 4 recovery residencies, and to receive state support, the facilities must adhere to the National Alliance for Recovery Residencies quality standards and renew its credentials through Maryland's Mental Health Association each year. For their work at the refuge and Leona May's house, Peace by Peace and Aquila were each issued short-term contracts with the state of Delaware, ending in June of this year. Those contracts total about $275,000. Saad Solomon says he hopes to continue to be a resource for the state after the contracts are up, and Director Romero says the state plans to launch at least three more Level 4 facilities over the next 2 years, including a treatment center for women and their children and another integrated treatment home in Harrington operated by Connections. For Delaware Public Media, I'm Nick Shalino.
Thanks, Nick. And stay with us. When The Green returns, we'll meet the authors of a new book that aims to help girls of color love their skin tone. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Children of color can internalize society's harmful messages about skin tone at a young age. It's an issue two Delaware moms tackle in their children's book called I Love Your Brown. And Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt sat down with those moms this week to discuss the book and the issue.
Atiyah Chase is a blogger and teaching specialist in the Colonial School District, and Danaya Jacobs is a social entrepreneur, blogger, and founder of the nonprofit Mom and Me, Inc. They're both moms and co-authors of the children's book, I Love Your Brown. This book is a poem. It's sort of in the form of a letter from a mother to a daughter. So I was wondering if you could start us off by reading a little bit. Can you start with, although challenges will come?
Absolutely. It says, although challenges will come, trust that your purpose will outweigh any bad day. There will be plenty of messages that tell you that you can't. Avoid them. Ignore them. They're only distractions.
Remember, your biggest competition is you. It is not the brown girl standing next to you. Practice being your sister's keeper, not just for brown girls, but for all girls.
So, what prompted you to write this book?
Well, my daughter, Bella, at the time was 3 years old when the idea came. We were reading a book. It was some random book that we were reading in her room while we were cleaning up. And her hand fell on top of mine. And she immediately noticed the difference. And I assume that she noticed the difference because she said, Mommy, I want to be peach like you. And so as a mother, it, you know, breaks your heart that, you know, you're realizing that this kid is having some issues here, apparently with skin color. And I think about how we had her in lots of activities. She was in swimming and soccer and dance, and she went to preschool at the time, and there were not many kids in her class that looked like her. So she is a little chocolate fudgy little girl, and so she didn't see other chocolate fudgy girls in her classroom. And when she said she wanted to be peach, it broke my heart. And the only thing that I could come up with, I mustered up all of the wisdom that a mother has in that moment, and all I could say was, Bella, I love your brown. And so that just immediately stuck with me, and I enlisted the help of my good friend Danaya to help me because I knew that there were other brown girls in the world that were like Bella who were having issues with their skin color.
So I love when Atiyah talks and she shares her side of things and how we kind of met in the middle. I think I was inspired by my daughter's grit at the time. She was doing gymnastics, level 1 competitive gymnastics, which is cartwheels at the most, but it's on a beam. And I just remember being so inspired by her grit and her ability to fearlessly flip on beams that I would be afraid to walk on. So that evening from one of her competitions where she did extremely well, we went home. If you've ever been to a gymnastics competition, you know they're super long, like tons of hours. So I went home and I went to sleep naturally and woke up in the middle of the night with a poem. And I had never hadn't written in years, but I remember feeling like this poem was what Atiyah was asking me to work with her on. Like this was the project that we would create together.
So I know both of you have worked with girls beyond your own families. And I'm wondering if this phenomenon of little girls feeling insecure about their skin tone or other aspects of themselves, is this something you see a lot?
After having a daughter and experiencing this with her, I would say that I am more aware and more conscious of it. I can't say that it's something that I thought about because I was on, I'm on the other end of the spectrum. I'm, you know, a little lighter. So I never got like comments about, you know, me being dark, but I did get comments about, oh, you must have like Puerto Rican in your family because my hair is curly, or you might have Indian in your family.
You don't have
Puerto Rican in your family? No, I don't have. Oh, okay. Not that I know of. So I'm more conscious of it now because I have this kid that's experiencing this in school.
I can completely relate to Tia's experience of not necessarily being of a darker hue. And so I definitely had that experience. But when I first started my work in girl work, which is the only way I can explain it, it was inspired by things that I would see in the media. For college, I decided that I was going to study fashion marketing. So I just became intrigued again with this whole idea of what's influencing today's generation. I remember having a girlfriend who was equally interested in fashion as I was, and I couldn't have been more than 18 maybe at the time. And she and I was on a train riding into New York City, and she says to me while looking at this magazine together, "Danae, if you could be any white girl, who would you be?" And that always stuck with me. It always resonated with me. And whenever I would do girl work, I would speak about that moment on the train with my friend. And that, I think, was my first real moment when I realized that her experience as a black woman was a little bit different than mine, that she actually, when she thought of fashion and what was high fashion, she immediately thought of white women. And when she thought of ratchet, for lack of better words, and streetwear, she immediately thought of fashion like that being appropriate for black women. So for her, wanting to be a white woman was a thing because that was who was wearing the couture gowns. Mm-hmm. So that was really probably my first introduction to being aware that there was something happening, some conversation that was happening internally with people and in a bigger scheme with the media influencing what people thought about their color.
We've been talking a lot about messaging around physical appearance. When I read the book, I got that there are other messages, too, you want to reaffirm your daughters about. Talk to me about some of those.
Oh, yeah. I love books that talk about color as far as being a crayon. There's books that talk about, like, I can't even remember the name of it, but it talks about being in the crayon box and that everybody has these differences. So one thing that I know that I want Bella and other girls and boys in the world to remember is that it's, you know, you're unique and you stand out in the crayon box. The world is huge. There's so many colors. There's so many abilities. And you're going to stand out in that crayon box, and so are other people. And just embrace the people that are around you. Learn to love who you are. And if you can learn to love who you are, you have no problem loving other people. Mm-hmm. So it does build girls up from that aspect as being, you know, looking at yourself on the inside, looking at what you possess as far as your abilities, your skills, those things that interest you. And that is ultimately what is going to make you a successful person in the world. And it's going to make you somebody that's relatable and approachable as a person. So I always want girls to feel like, you know, if I love me, then I can love you because I love me first.
Danae.
So the line I read to trust that your biggest competition is you is probably one of my favorite. I think what's hard for me sometimes with the book, if I'm completely honest, is as I read it, every time we have an opportunity to read it, it reminds me of words that I have to eat even as an adult. And not just for my own life, but watching and living vicariously through Jada's experiences. So she's still competing in gymnastics. And there's times when she competes where I have to say those words to me. Her biggest competition is her. Her biggest competition is her. It's not all these girls that's here competing for the same one gold medal. Those messages, I think, are so important because as women, it's so easy to compete.
I want to talk about the images in the book a little bit. You have a bunch of models that are young brown girls, and you have them dressed up as different, I guess I would say, occupations or doing different things. So talk to me about the philosophy behind that, how you went about creating those images.
This is probably the most fun part of the project.
Yes. I think at the very least, we wanted it to be representation. Oftentimes in media, and it's becoming better, you don't see brown people or brown girls, you know, owning the boardroom, right? Or you don't see women, period, owning the boardroom. You know, we've just gotten a little bit better with that, you know, more comfortable. So that idea of representation, we wanted that to stand out. Like, you can be in the boardroom. You can wear a construction hat. I think I love
that's one of my favorite
that
too.
One because it just defies the odds. We wanted to just stir that kind of just spirit amongst girls. Like, I really can be anything if I choose to be anything.
Mm-hmm. Diversity was so big for us when creating this book, and diversity, not just with brown girls. We actually at one point, especially for the picture where it says not just your sisters, not just for brown girls, but for all girls. What I love about the models in the book is that we weren't looking for models, and every single girl that applied, we accepted. And then I think what was also really fun is how quickly we pieced it all together. The wardrobe that the kids are wearing are literally pieces from then Jada and Bella's closet. We had the construction hat was a dad whose daughter was participating, happened to be a construction worker, and happened to have a construction hat in his truck when we were shooting the book. It was awesome. It was a great time.
Yeah, thank you for describing that. There are two phrases in the book that I want to ask you about why you included them. Mm-hmm. One is, your light comes from a deep place, from your mother's mother's mother. The other is, baby, set ablaze to the path that has been laid.
I'll take the first one. You want to do the second one? Okay.
I think they both, the reason I pair them together is they speak to kind of a history. So I'd like to hear about that.
So this is another favorite of mine, and this line spoke to me in particular when I thought about all the women that came before me and came before Tia. We always talk about our grandmothers, but my mom had a really close relationship with her great-grandmother, who was Tilly Kay, and my great-grandmother raised my mother, Bernice, and then my grandmother, Beverly, then my mom, then me, then Jada, and we've all had daughters first and then sons. So when I think about the women in my family, the ones I didn't even know, my mom tells such good stories of my great-grandmother Tilly Kay that I feel like I know Tilly Kay. I oftentimes say that it's the prayers that Tilly Kay prayed for me that probably got me out of some trouble I don't even know about before she met me, but I don't remember her. So when I think about your beauty being uncompromising and it coming from your mother's mother's mother, I think about this place of strength and grit and wisdom of the women that came before us and how now that wisdom through storytelling from our mothers and our grandmothers is passed down to our daughters. I want little girls to know that there are women that came before them that had light and that that light that they see inside of them is beaming from them. I think my last point, now being pregnant, that I think was super cool. Once a baby is growing, if it's a girl, she has all her eggs that she's going to have for a lifetime while she's inside of your womb. So your grandmother technically carried you. So my mother technically carried my children because I had all my eggs when I was still inside her womb. And when I think about that, just how interconnected we are as women and how amazing that is that we carry our grandchildren before that even happens, all of that kind of comes together for me.
Baby set ablaze to the path that has been laid. I mean, it takes me immediately back to ancestors. Like, the book pays homage to that. Like, we are a creative, brilliant, wonderful people, right? And so when you set ablaze that path, you're just taking the baton from the person that's before you, and you're just running to carry it out. It also speaks to do the right thing now. because there's a path that somebody else is going to have to follow that comes after you. So just making sure that you take the baton and you run with it with the grace and the grit, and you get rid of the insecurities that you have and don't get distracted by them.
I Love Your Brown is available on Amazon and the Barnes & Noble at the Christiana Mall. Atiya Chase and Danaya Jacobs, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks to Atiya Chase, Danaya Jacobs, and our Sophia Schmidt for their time on The Green this week. Next, we have more on an educational program that's celebrating 10 years of explaining Odessa's connection to the Underground Railroad. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Historic Houses of Odessa and the Historic Odessa Foundation are celebrating the 10th anniversary of an educational program for students and the public focused on the Underground Railroad. It's called Freedom Seekers, the Odessa Story. It started in 2009, shortly after the National Park Service added Odessa's Corbett Sharp House, a National Historic Landmark, to the National Underground Railroad Network to Freedom. The program chronicles the story of a fugitive slave named Sam and his connection to this first state stop on the Underground Railroad. This week, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele chats with Johnny Baker, education curator at the Historic Odessa Foundation, about this program.
The Historic Houses of Odessa, very fascinating place, but today we want to focus in on an educational journey awaiting students at the Historic Houses of Odessa. Johnny, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Kelly.
Talk to me about this. For a while now, children have been learning about the life of a fugitive slave traveling under the cover of darkness, of course, with limited supplies at a historic stop on the Underground Railroad in Delaware. Take us back and then chronologically walk us through this story.
Sure. One of the things, Kelly, that we found when we were starting to design this program is that sticking to authentic facts was sometimes, with this subject, a little bit difficult. There's so much urban legend that has grown up around the Underground Railroad. And if you talk to any of the old-timers here in town in Odessa or in the MOT area, everybody's got a story about their great-great-great-great-grandfather and grandmother and the Underground Railroad. So the first thing we really had to do was sift through all this urban legend and come up with a program that reflected the facts as they actually happened. And then you got something else that you have to deal with, and that's the fact that so little facts exist. Not much was written down. It was too dangerous, too incriminating. And after the Fugitive Slave Law was written, anyone who was aiding and abetting slaves was really in for a boatload of trouble. So the people who were doing this, particularly in this area, the Methodists and the Quakers and our free black population, and even some of the Native American tribes around here, they were doing so at great risk. But we were able to find a couple pieces of information that really did substantiate the fact that the Corbett Sharp House, one of our historic properties at the Historic Odessa Foundation, actually was a stop on the Underground Railroad. But I'll tell you the truth, it took the National Park Service 5 years of vetting to finally decide that we qualified.
And why is that? What were the qualifications that you had to meet? What took them so long?
It was really, really rigorous. And again, any corroborating evidence that you had to the fact that you were a site on the Underground Railroad needed something substantial to back it up. And it took a good while for them to look at everything we had. And what we had was rather fragmentary, but it was enough. And at the time we applied, there were a lot of other sites around the country applying. And from what I understand, talking to the regional director of the National Park Service Underground Railroad Network to Freedom, very few of them actually were able to be designated as sites. We only have three in Delaware, and I think we're about the only one giving tours. Now, there are other Underground Railroad sites, but not necessarily part of the National Park Service.
Other underground sites in Delaware?
Yes, yes. And in fact, probably one of the best ways that people can check that out is to look at the Harriet Tubman Byway website, and they have a lot of information, and a lot of that was done in coordination with Maryland, because unlike what a lot of people stereotypically think, most of the slaves, fugitive slaves coming through Delaware, weren't coming from the South. They were coming from the West. They were coming from Maryland. And Maryland and Delaware worked in conjunction with each other on the development of the byway. And you can actually follow in the footsteps of Harriet Tubman. You can actually look and see the kinds of routes that a lot of fugitive slaves were taking as they were escaping north to freedom.
Yeah, and the public was recently, we want to let everybody know, the public was recently invited to celebrate Harriet Tubman Day by visiting the Historic Odessa Foundation's National Park Service Network to Freedom exhibit, which is called Freedom Seekers, the Odessa Story.
Correct. And we had we celebrated that and had a huge number of people that came in and went through our exhibit, recognizing the fact that we can't substantiate the fact that Harriet Tubman ever came through here. And again, we're real careful to only, at least at this site, talk about things that we can really underpin with facts. But was it likely that she did? Probably, but we can't substantiate it. But she was active in this area, and because of that, we joined the byway. And plus, we just kind of enriched the peripheral story to her struggles and to the work that she did for the Underground Railroad. Now, keeping in mind that probably our primary mission here at the Historic Odessa Foundation is education. Once we were vetted as a site in the National Park Service Network to Freedom, first thing that I wanted to do was develop a program for kids, because that's our main thrust. And once I did, and we started getting kids come through the program, I actually had children who would later come back on weekends with their parents to see the exhibit, and we began to realize, you know, this has a dual purpose. We can certainly be giving adults and the walk-in public also a good look at our story.
Are the students, the children coming through specifically for an educational purpose through their school districts, or are they coming through with their families, their caregivers, because they're truly interested in this?
I think it's a combination of both. Now, I will say the bulk of the kids coming through the program are coming through with their school groups, or we've got Cub Scout groups that come through if we've got kids who are working on American history badges. We have Girl Scout groups that are coming through. We have church groups that are coming through. But the bulk of them are school kids, because one of the things that we really like to do with our school program is not only enhance what's going on in the classroom, but we want to address Delaware State standards. And we want to make sure that what we're doing corresponds with the curriculum. And this certainly does, particularly the American history curriculum. So it fits in nicely, and teachers have really found it to be valuable.
All right, so walk me through step by step. Students participating in Freedom Seekers, the Odessa Story program, how do they begin their journey?
They actually follow in the footsteps of Sam. Now, Sam, we know, was a fugitive slave who came into the Odessa area on foot from the west. Today it would probably be down Main Street or Route 299 coming from Middletown to Odessa. But at that time it was really just a cart path that went from the Chesapeake Bay down here to the Appaquinimic River. and we know he came down this way, hid during the day, and real early on the following morning, he knocked on the door of the Corbett Sharp house and asked for refuge. He was being pursued by a posse that was coming from Middletown, and that posse had with them his former slave owner from Maryland, and there was a big reward on his head. Apparently, Sam was a very valuable slave. Well, when he knocked on the door of the Corbett house, the only person at home, really, except for some servants, was Mrs. Daniel Corbett. Now, we know that Daniel Corbett was an active abolitionist, her husband, in this area. And we actually know that from the trial of John Hunn and Thomas Garrett, which is probably a landmark case here in Delaware. But introduced into evidence was a little piece of paper that a fugitive slave was apprehended with. And on that piece of paper were the names John Alston, John Hunn, and Daniel Corbett. And these were three abolitionists that apparently this group of runaway slaves, they were supposed to contact for refuge. Well, interestingly enough, that was introduced into the evidence of this trial, and we have then in writing that Daniel Corbett was actually an abolitionist in this area. Again, a piece of information that really is pretty rare to find, somebody's name actually written down. So apparently Sam knew this. He asked for refuge into the house. He's being pursued by a posse. And at that point, Mrs. Corbett has to decide, all right, this is against the law to harbor and to hide and to aid and abet a fugitive slave. She did it at great risk to herself. She got him into the house, got him through a back stairway up to the third floor, and there hid him in a cubbyhole in the eaves of the attic. And she no longer got him hidden than there was a knock at the door. She goes down the stairs. She answers the door, and it is the sheriff's posse. So here she is confronted with the authorities, who seem to think that Sam is in the house. Now, she protested and said no, he was not. However, they wanted to search the house. And that was a pretty bold move because she was, part of a very prominent family here in Odessa. But nevertheless, they did. So it must have been really important to them to get Sam. She led them in. They searched the house. She opened closets for them. They looked around. And they got up into the third floor. And she kind of laughingly but nervously said, oh, Sam couldn't be anywhere up here, especially not behind that little door that runs along the eaves. If your slave was a field hand, he was probably pretty robust. I don't think anybody could fit in there. And the sheriff agreed with her, continued to search through the rest of the attic, found nothing, and left. Very relieved, she then took Sam some food, gave him a quilt, and when nightfall came, she took him down to what we would think of as Route 13, the King's Road up to Wilmington, and she sent him on his way. Now, I said we don't like to do anything without some kind of authentication. Well, this was a story and kind of a legend in this area for a long time. And that would have not been enough to hang our hat on to make the Corbett Sharp House a stop on the Underground Railroad. But what really clinched it for us, besides that little piece of paper in the John Hunn and Thomas Garrett trial with Corbett's name on it, was the fact that in 1914, Mary Corbett Warner talked to a group of colonial dames of America in Wilmington. And apparently this was a group of socialites. And every month they liked to get together and have a little luncheon, and then one of them would get up and recount some kind of historical story about their family that was significant. And Mary Corbett Warner told this story of Sam and said that it had happened in the late 1840s to her mother, who was Mrs. Daniel Corbett. And when we were able to find an actual copy of this speech in the Delaware Historical Society, we were able to nail this story.
This is just all so fascinating. What has been the feedback from the students that have gone through the program already?
They absolutely love it. Now, when we start, the kids get here and they actually go to one of our outbuildings, which is on our property. Our property is pretty extensive and extends down to the river. We have an old muskrat skinning shed, and in there we have exhibits on the actual institution of slavery, slavery and abolitionism in Delaware. And we kind of go through the academics of that briefly in the beginning, and the kids are they're accompanied by a costume guide who will explain some of this to them. It's kind of the nuts and bolts of the peculiar institution of slavery and abolitionism, and then kind of orient them to where Maryland was, to where the river, where Philadelphia is, kind of give them a point of reference. And at that point, all the kids are given haversacks. And these are the kind of haversacks that maybe an escaping or fugitive slave would have. And the kids get to go through it and see some of the things that the slaves would take with them. It might be, oh, a tiny little cut-off piece of a candle that a slave was able to steal. It might be some flint and steel to make a fire. Maybe if they were lucky, they were able to get a compass, steal one from the master's house. Maybe it's a little piece, a little bit of food, an Abiquinimic cake or something like that. But as the kids are looking in their haversacks, they're noticing that not all of them have all of these supplies. Some of them have nothing. Some of them are well supplied. Some of them have a few things. And they begin to realize that slaves had different things depending upon opportunity. Escape was a product of opportunity. You took your chance when you could, and if you didn't have food, so be it. You still took off and you tried to live off the land.
Absolutely. All right, we're talking to Johnny Baker, the Historic Odessa Foundation's executive curator, about Freedom Seekers, the Odessa Story program. Johnny, is this program ongoing? I mean, it's not going to wrap up at some point.
Oh, no, this is not a temporary exhibit. This is an integral part of our school program, and it's also something that we offer to the public throughout the year. And when people come here to take a general house tour of our houses and properties, the Underground Railroad is part of that tour, or they can come for a reduced price and just see the Underground Railroad part, because after they get a chance to kind of look at the historical background of slavery, then we invite them to actually follow in Sam's footsteps and go from our muskrat skinning shed, which is the outbuilding that we use for our displays, and then actually go to the back door of the Corbett house, go up the back stairs, and actually see where Sam is hidden up in the cubby. And we have a mannequin in the cubby, and particularly the kids get a chance to see how really confining it was and how scary probably this whole trip was, because we'll tell the kids, okay, especially the real little ones will say, we're going to go across this open yard and we're going to knock on the back door and we're going to see if we can get into the house to hide. And the little ones, they get so into it that they actually, as they're going across the backyard, they will crouch down or hide behind a tree. And the guides have to kind of corral them to get them to the back door and then take them up the back stairs to the cubby.
How can people get more information about this?
It's easy. All that they have to do is look at our website at historicodessa.org, and we have specific information about our Freedom Seekers program, and we also have specific information about the school program so that if we have any teachers who are interested in this as part of a big tour or strictly a dedicated tour to Freedom Seekers, they can do that also. And it gives you, it gives them all the contact information right on our website and kind of an overview of the program.
Thanks to Johnny Baker, education curator at the Historic Odessa Foundation, and our Kelly Steele for joining us on The Green this week to discuss Freedom Seekers, the Odessa story at the Historic Houses of Odessa. More information about the program and its availability to the public and schools is available at historicodessa.org. And we finish up this week's edition of The Green with Enlighten Me and a look at the start of a new baseball season for the Wilmington Blue Rocks. That's next on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. April is here, and with it, another baseball season. For the Wilmington Blue Rocks, the 2019 campaign that kicked off earlier this week at Frawley Stadium is the franchise's 27th on the Wilmington Riverfront. The team remains popular with fans and one of the top draws in the Single-A Carolina League. While attendance has dipped slightly the past two seasons, the Rocks still averaged about 3,800 fans per game in both 2017 and 2018. And there's no reason to expect things will change this year with some of the Kansas City Royals' top prospects on the roster and another schedule filled with unique promotions and giveaways. For this week's Enlighten Me, I paid a visit to Frawley Stadium to chat with Director of Broadcasting and Video, Corey Nido, the team's lead play-by-play voice, as well as its Marketing Director, Jason Estes, about what to expect on and off the field this spring and summer. Let's, Corey, start with you and the team on the field. This is a pretty impressive roster. A lot of top Kansas City prospects on this roster. Tell us a little bit about some of the names people are going to see as they come out to the ballpark this year.
You're absolutely right. Overall on this roster, you have 11 of the top 27 prospects in the Kansas City Royals organization. You look around minor league baseball, you just don't see that. You see maybe 3 to 5, maybe a little bit more, but to have 11 on one roster, it's really exciting. It's headlined by Brady Singer, the Royals' first overall pick in last year's draft out of the University of Florida. And then they really stocked up on college pitchers after Singer. They picked up Singer's teammate, Jackson Kowar, who was with the Gators. They've been roommates since college. Daniel Lynch, the University of Virginia product. Those three really spearheaded the draft, and they're all now going to be part of the starting rotation. And then, of course, you have some returners like Daniel Tillo, who's a top 30 prospect, and then Nolan Watson, who was a first-round pick by the Royals back in 2015. So four of the five starting pitchers potentially are first-round picks, which is mind-boggling if you just think about it. Position players, MJ Melendez is the catcher, a very highly touted catching prospect. He's a top 10 catching prospect in all of minor league baseball. He's worked with Salvador Perez, who's been a perennial all-star for the Royals, a former Blue Rock as well. Nick Prado is the fifth best prospect in the system. He was the Royals' first overall pick 2 years ago in the 2017 draft out of high school. And then you look around, Sully Matias out in right field, a Dominican Republic native. He signed for over $2 million when he was a teenager. Hit 31 home runs in just 94 games last year. A remarkable, powerful hitter. And Kyle Isbell, and also an outfielder. He's very pesky out of UNLV, a third-round pick in this last year's draft. Up and down this lineup, this roster, it's absolutely talented.
You mentioned that this is highly unusual. Is there a sense that these guys are likely to stay for a good part of the season, particularly since a number of them are very recent draft picks? Or is it more of a sense that these guys might move very quickly if they get off to a good start?
I think it really depends on what Kansas City wants to do with them and depending on how these players develop. I don't think they would move them all up together. I think it's more so, hey, if player A is pitching lights out, we're going to move them up to Double-A because they want to develop them and not stunt their growth. But there's nothing that says they're keeping this group together, but from the outside looking in, a lot of people around baseball think this is the next group for Kansas City to win a world championship.
A lot of times it is nice to move those guys along as a group and let them kind of develop together, right?
Absolutely. We were talking to some of the players and the manager, Scott Thorman. They really built chemistry down in Lexington last year when they won the championship. And some of those players, like a Daniel Lynch, a Jackson Kowar, they didn't join the team until later on in the season. So you're joining a new team, a new family, so to speak, and to just blend right in, mesh, and then really help them win a championship. It says a lot about the character of these players.
You mentioned the manager, Scott Thorman. He is new, but his coaching staff, familiar names to at least some Blue Rocks fans, right?
Absolutely. Steve Luber, the pitching coach, for sure. He's been here for a long time. He spent the previous 2 years up in AA Northwest Arkansas, back down here with Wilmington to really work hands-on with this talented pitching core that we mentioned. And then, Scott Thorman, first-year manager here. He's been around. He played in the Carolina League. And then the hitting coach, Larry Sutton, he still holds the single-season record for most home runs in a season with 26 back in the early 90s. I met him for the first time. He's a pleasant gentleman. Really looking forward to working with the staff, and certainly recognizable faces for these fans when they come.
I'll betray my age. I was here when Larry Sutton hit those home runs covering the Blue Rocks. So that tells you a little bit about how long I've been around with this team, and it's great to see him back in some of these familiar names. I want to move over to kind of the off-the-field portion of this, and Jason, let's bring you in now. One of the things that's been remarkable, I think, about this team is its ability to kind of maintain consistency with attendance. I mean, over the entire life of this franchise, always around the top, if not at the top of Carolina League in attendance, and pretty steady in terms of the numbers, upper 200,000 to 300,000 fans per year. How important is that to the organization to be able to show that kind of consistency on a regular basis to keep these fans coming out year after year?
It's super important. Like Corey was saying, we have great talent on the field this year, but that's something that we don't really control. It's more of a Kansas City Royals thing. So we try to make sure that every single fan has a great time here. Whether the Blue Rocks lose or win on the field, we're doing promotions in between innings. We're doing something different every day of the week, trying to make sure that people have a good time and want to come back.
I want to go back to you for a second, Corey. How important is it for those players to have that kind of atmosphere here at the ballpark at this level, even if their time here is short-lived?
I think it plays a huge part into playing in front of a large crowd. You go to some different leagues at the same level, and they're drawing barely 1,000 fans. So I feel like players definitely thrive off of it, feed off the energy, and we have some of the most passionate fans in all of minor league baseball. And you mentioned the numbers. They come out year after year, and we couldn't be more thankful.
And Jason, you mentioned promotions. Let's talk a little bit about that. That's one of the things that obviously is a big draw to fans. What are some of the key promotions people should be looking forward to this season?
We're bringing back some fan favorites like the Dogfish Head Beer 30 Thursday. We're doing fireworks every Friday night here at Frawley Stadium. And then we have some new things like Dog Days on Tuesdays. So every Tuesday, fans can bring their dogs. Dogs get in free. We're also doing dollar hot dogs and some drink specials as well. So trying to do something different every day of the week and really make sure that people have a good time here.
How about some of the one-offs, the giveaways, the appearances, any of those that you want to highlight for people?
Absolutely. We're doing some really fun bobbleheads this year. We're doing a Rocky Skywinkle bobblehead on our Star Wars night, so a little playoff of Luke Skywalker. Bringing in some celebrities like the actor who played Al Borland on Home Improvement, John O'Hurley, who played Jay Peterman on Seinfeld, Jake the Snake Roberts for some wrestling fans, as well as the actor who played Smalls in The Sandlot.
And I guess the other thing that is new this year on the weekends, you're opening the gates a half hour early for fans on Saturdays and Sundays. What was the rationale behind giving them a little bit more time in the stadium before the game?
Exactly. Yeah, we've heard some feedback that fans really like to enjoy batting practice. So especially with the talented roster we have this year, we thought it'd be nice to let fans come in a little earlier, see the guys on the field practicing a little more before the game.
Anything else that's new at the ballpark that people might not recognize if they were out here last year?
Yeah, so food, we have Chickies and Pete's and Grotto, which are coming back again, but we also have Baltimore Crab Cake Company. So bringing in some crab cakes to the ballpark, they're really good. They came in for samples and the staff went crazy, so we think the fans are really going to enjoy that.
For someone who hasn't been to a Blue Rocks game before and maybe coming out for the first time this year, do you have any advice for them about maybe the for lack of a better term, best practices for enjoying your first time out at a Blue Rocks game?
I think just the minor league experience is pretty great. I'd recommend get here early, go get some autographs from the players before the game. You can get right up next to the field and meet the guys. These are the guys you might be seeing in the big leagues in a few years. So it's pretty cool to have that really close, intimate experience here at Frawley Stadium that you can't necessarily get in the big leagues.
Thanks to Blue Rocks lead radio broadcaster Corey Nido and marketing director Jason Estes for enlightening us about the 2019 Blue Rocks season on The Green this week. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino, Sophia Schmidt, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bernstein. Thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.